History Daily is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy. Just drop in some details about yourself and see if you're eligible to save money when you bundle your home and auto policies. The process only takes minutes, and it could mean hundreds more in your pocket. So visit Progressive.com after this episode to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states. It's the morning of February 26, 1935, in the countryside near Daventry, a town in central England. 42-year-old Scottish physicist Robert Watson Watt rocks from side to side as the van he's driving bounces along a muddy track. Clinging to the seat beside him is his younger colleague, Skip Wilkins. With a crunch of gears, Robert turns off the road, then brings the vehicle to a skittering stop beside a field. The cold air hits him as he steps out. In the middle of the field is a square of four wooden poles topped with wire stretching between them. Robert has spent the past couple of days putting them up, and he's still got blisters from digging in the hard, icy ground. But the discomfort will be worth it if this experiment goes to plan. A month ago, the British military came to Robert with an alarming rumor. Intelligence reports claimed that the German army was developing a death ray, a powerful gun that used radio waves to shoot planes out of the sky. Robert quickly dismissed this idea as science fiction, but it got him and his colleague Skip thinking about a different question: whether radio waves could be used not to destroy incoming aircraft, but to detect them. And today, they intend to find out. Two cables hang limply from the poles. Robert takes one and drags it to the back of the van. Skip does the same with the second. Robert swings open the rear door. Until recently, this was just a delivery van, but now a radio receiver has been bolted to the floor. Robert connects the two long cables to the receiver and then switches on the machine. Then he sits down on a stool in front of its screen and waits. He knows that 8 miles away, a Royal Air Force pilot is flying a steady circuit at 5,000 feet. If Robert and Skip's calculations are correct, radio waves from a nearby transmitter will hit the plane, bounce back, and appear as a flicker on their screen. Lingering just outside, Skip stamps his feet, trying to keep warm in the bitter cold. But Robert is as still as a statue, his eyes never leaving the display. Suddenly, the screen sparks to life. Robert's heart lurches. It's the plane. It has to be. Skip claps him on the shoulder. They've done what seems almost impossible. They've pinpointed the position of a plane they can't even see. While their experiment is crude, it's enough to convince the Royal Air Force that this new technology might be useful. But radar, as it comes to be known, will soon prove much more important than anyone expected. It will transform Britain's defenses and help the country survive an aerial onslaught that will be launched just 5 years after Robert Watson Watt's successful demonstration on February 26, 1935. I'm still putting the finishing touches on my live show. I've got about 10 days left before we begin rehearsals, and it's kind of stressful. But the reason is, I'm packing this show with all sorts of entertainment. There's history, of course, but also drama, music, maps, even time series population charts, and I know you love a good data visualization. Speaking of visualizations, imagine this. The perfect seat, dead center in the theater, not too close and not too far from stage. Well, that one's been sold already. Tickets are going fast for the Dallas show, so buy yours today. And to be the first to know when we announce new dates, go to historydailylive.com to register for details. That's historydailylive.com. History Daily is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy. Just drop in some details about yourself and see if you're eligible to save money when you bundle your home and auto policies. The process only takes minutes, and it could mean hundreds more in your pocket. So visit Progressive.com after this episode to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Yeah. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. Yeah. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
From Noiser and Airship, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is History Daily. History is made every day. On this podcast, every day, we tell the true stories of the people and events that shaped our world. Today is February 26, 1935, the birth of radar. It's March 1935 at the Air Ministry in London, England, 1 week after a team of scientists detected an airplane using radio waves. Sitting at the head of a conference table, 53-year-old Air Marshal Hugh Dowding frowns as he flips through a dense scientific paper. Dowding is no stranger to advanced technology. He's trained as an artillery officer before transferring to the Air Force. Still, the document in front of him is difficult to follow, filled with complex equations and unfamiliar terminology. Across the table from him, 3 members of the Committee for the Scientific Survey of Air Defense wait patiently, their hands clasped in their laps. The idea of using radio waves to locate objects isn't new, and Britain isn't the only country exploring it. But there had long been doubts about whether the theory was workable outside a lab. So when the committee approached Air Marshal Dowding and proposed using radio waves to detect incoming aircraft, he was skeptical. Still, he recognized that if the scientists could make it work, it had the potential to transform Britain's defenses. So he told them to go away and demonstrate that the theory could work in the real world. If they could do that, he said they could have all the funding they wanted. Led by Scottish scientist Robert Watson Watt, these scientists built a simple prototype that successfully tracked a plane by bouncing a radio signal off the aircraft and back to a receiver in a field 8 miles away. Now they've returned to London to claim their reward, money for further research into what they call radio direction finding, but everyone else will soon call it radar. After finishing the final page of the report, Air Marshal Dowding looks up at the scientists. Then, without a word, he turns the report over, lowers his eyes, and begins reading a second time. The scientists shift uneasily in their chairs. But this time, when Dowding reaches the end, a flicker of a smile creases the corners of his mouth. He stands up and extends his hand. Congratulating the men on their work, he says that he sees huge potential in this technology. One of the scientists eagerly raises the question of funding. Dowding's face flushes as he remembers what he promised. But Britain is still feeling the strain of the Great Depression, and budgets across the government are tight. So Dowding adjusts his earlier offer. The scientists will receive enough money to get a radar system up and running, but it's not a blank check. If the costs get too high, he'll have to shut them down. Over the next year, the scientific committee oversees the construction of a radar station on England's east coast. To keep costs low, they use existing technology wherever possible. But once that first station is operational, more quickly follow. By 1938, the individual sites are linked together in a single network known as Chain Home. What began as a prototype in a field has grown into a web of 100-foot radar towers, and together they cover most of southern Britain and all the crucial approaches to London. But even with the world's first integrated air defense system in place, Air Marshal Dowding still sees room for improvement. Radar can provide up to 15 minutes warning of incoming aircraft, but it can't tell friend from foe, and scrambling an entire fighter squadron to intercept a lone off-course pilot would be a costly mistake. To solve this problem, Dowding establishes a single command post. The data from every radar station in the country feeds into this one place, where information is combined with the latest intelligence reports and sightings phoned in by trained observers along the coast. Only after all this information is assessed do officers determine whether to launch fighters. It becomes known as the Dowding system, and it's up and running just in time. Because for years, Nazi leader Adolf Hitler has been expanding the German military, including its air force, the Luftwaffe. And when Hitler orders his troops into Poland in September 1939, Britain is given a stark reminder of just how destructive modern air power can be. The Luftwaffe quickly seizes control of the skies over Poland, its bombers destroying airfields, bridges, and railway lines. Its fighter planes attack troops caught in the open, and with the Germans enjoying total aerial supremacy, Poland falls in less than a month. But all of Europe knows that Hitler won't stop there. Soon he will turn his attention west, and when he does, Air Marshal Hugh Downing and scientists like Robert Watson Watt will find out whether the air defense system they've built will be enough to protect Britain from what's coming. History Daily is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy. Just drop in some details about yourself and see if you're eligible to save money when you bundle your home and auto policies. The process only takes minutes, and it could mean hundreds more in your pocket. So visit Progressive.com after this episode to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states. It's June 18, 1940, at the Air Ministry in London, 9 months after the beginning of World War II. Air Marshal Hugh Downing checks the time, then rises from his desk and crosses the room to the radio. He switches it on, clasps his hands behind his back, and gazes out at the city streets below. In a few moments, Prime Minister Winston Churchill is due to address the nation. Downing is eager to hear how Churchill will break the grim news that Downing knows all too well: Britain is losing the war. Just over a month ago, Germany invaded France and overran the country with stunning speed. After putting up brief resistance, thousands of British and Allied soldiers were evacuated from Dunkirk on the northern coast. That retreat was a stunning feat of logistics under fire, but it didn't disguise the awful truth. In Europe, Britain is now the last major power fighting to resist the German advance, and only the narrow English Channel protects the country from Adolf Hitler's armies. And even then, an invasion is expected. Downing wonders how the usually bombastic Churchill will address the moment. But as he listens through crackling static, he quickly realizes that Churchill is adopting a more somber tone than usual.
The Battle of France is over. I expect that the Battle of Britain is about to begin. Upon this battle depends the survival of Christian civilized nations.
Churchill is not shying away from the devastating collapse of France, but he does highlight the resolve of the British people. He insists that Britain will never surrender, and he declares that future generations will remember this as the country's finest hour. As the commander of Britain's fighter squadrons, Air Marshal Downing feels a heavy burden. Military planners expect Hitler to repeat the tactics that proved so successful in Poland and France, wave after wave of aerial attacks followed by the rapid advance of ground troops. Men and women under Downing's command will be Britain's first line of defense. And within 2 weeks of Churchill's speech, the Germans launched the initial phase of their invasion plan. It goes exactly as expected. Luftwaffe pilots fly over the English Channel, determined to gain air superiority by shooting down British planes and bombing British airfields. If the Germans can neutralize the Royal Air Force and control the skies, there'll be nothing to stop Hitler's troops crossing the Channel and advancing on London. But the British have a secret weapon, the Downing system. Thanks to the web of radar towers that's been built across the country, Britain has advanced notice of German attacks. There's no need for British pilots to fly blindly up and down the coast, burning precious fuel in the hope they might encounter the enemy. Instead, they only need to take to the skies when the Germans are definitely on their way, and the RAF can fly into battle confident that they know where to find their enemy and in what strength. This strategy works. Almost 9 out of every 10 attacks are intercepted. Many German planes are driven back across the channel. Others don't return to base at all. In the first 2 weeks of this Battle of Britain, the RAF claims to have shot down over 150 enemy planes. But even with that impressive number, Downing still faces criticism. Despite knowing when and where the Germans will attack, he doesn't want to overcommit his limited resources and risk too many pilots and planes in any one engagement. Some more gung-ho members of the RAF think these cautious tactics may stave off defeat when they won't deliver victory. They'd rather use the advantage radar gives them to take the fight to the enemy. And it's not just officers in the RAF who oppose Dowding's approach. Maritime convoys carrying much-needed supplies to Britain are repeatedly targeted by the Luftwaffe, and many ships are sunk. But Dowding refuses to commit more than the bare minimum of resources to protecting these convoys. He believes the pivotal moment of the Battle of Britain is still to come, and he'll need every pilot and plane he has. Sure enough, Hitler's generals will soon launch what they hope will be a knockout blow against the RAF, an overwhelming attack designed to shatter Britain's defenses and pave the way for an all-out invasion. History Daily is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy. Just drop in some details about yourself and see if you're eligible to save money when you bundle your home and auto policies. The process only takes minutes, and it could mean hundreds more in your pocket. So visit Progressive.com after this episode to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states. It's August 13, 1940, in the skies above southern England, a month after the Battle of Britain began. Inside the cockpit of a Hawker Hurricane fighter plane, 29-year-old squadron leader Sailor Milan stares through the canopy, eyes scanning the pale blue horizon. He sees nothing yet, but over the radio, a calm voice assures him that the enemy is not far ahead. Only minutes later, the ground-based controller is proven right. A small cluster of black specks comes into view, growing larger by the second. For the last month, the Luftwaffe has flown dozens of missions over England, and time after time, the result has been the same. Almost every German plane crossing the Channel finds British fighters waiting for them. Frustrated by the lack of progress, Adolf Hitler has now given the go-ahead for Eagle Day, an enormous aerial attack designed to overwhelm the British defenses with sheer numbers. But thanks to the early warning radar system, the RAF has a crucial advantage. But even then, as Milan speeds closer to the enemy, he realizes he's facing more than 70 German planes. It will be a challenge for his squadron. But Milan is one of the RAF's best pilots, and he's a natural at the controls. He lines up behind a German bomber, squeezes his trigger, and then watches it fall away. It's a direct hit, but there's no time to celebrate. The enemy's guns have opened fire. Milan barrel rolls out of the way, diving, then climbing, twisting through the air at hundreds of miles an hour. All around him, engines roar and bullets fly. There are explosions and near misses. But by the time the dogfight is over, the Germans have retreated and lost at least five bombers. Similar scenes play out all across southern England. Hitler hoped that his pilots could deal the RAF a knockout blow on Eagle Day, but it's the Luftwaffe that's been served the defeat. After several more weeks of punishing losses, the Germans eventually changed their tactics. The Luftwaffe abandons its attempt to destroy the RAF and shifts to bombing British cities instead. These punishing raids become known as the Blitz, unleashing terror on the civilian population, but they're also a sign of weakness. The German leadership no longer thinks an invasion of Britain is feasible. Soon, Prime Minister Winston Churchill will return to the airwaves to pay tribute to the pilots of the RAF, many of whom lost their lives fighting above southern Britain.
Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few.
But victory in the Battle of Britain was not earned by the pilots' bravery alone. It also depended on the new technology that gave the RAF advance warning of incoming enemy planes, an advantage that was only possible thanks to the scientist Robert Watson Watt and the successful experiment he performed in a field on February 26, 1935. Next on History Daily, February 27, 1943. More than 1,000 Jews are released from Nazi detention after a protest on the streets of Berlin. From Neusser and Airship, this is History Daily, hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham. Audio editing by Mohammed Shazib. Sound design by Molly Bach. Music by Throng. This episode is written and researched by Owen Paul Nichols. Edited by Scott Reeves. Managing producer Emily Burke. Executive producers are William Simpson for Airship and Pascal Hughes for Noiser.